us about books that are have been influential in your life. Before we get started with that, I'd like to know, is there anybody that brought a book that they'd like to talk about or read an excerpt that didn't call me and they just brought the book? I got your name down. I got Laverne. I saw him bringing a book in. And so we got, is there a better way to start than at the top? Well, this is not necessarily the order in which they came in, but let's see. I think I'm going to, if they're, all of these are pretty mobile, so would you guys, we have space up here. I think I'll just start with Lauren Kipfer and ask you to come to the front. Betty Yoder, and if some of you want to wait down here on this side, that'll be fine. Sam D, Gideon, and Nathan. So if you'll all just come to the front, then we will call on you to, in turn, to talk about the book that you have. So this is going to be rather informal, so just... okay. Lauren, let's see. Let's start with you.
Well, I have a book here, The Shepherd of Zalm. It's spelled S-A-L-M, pronounced Zalm, with a Z, or as in you would say in the U.S., a Z. My niece talked with her a little while before we left for our trip to Israel and Europe, and she said, well, if you go to France, to the Principality of Zalm, you'll want to read this book. And so she told me where to get it. It's fresh off the press from Rod and Staff. Well, it was printed sometime last year. And it talks about, it's the story of the Topher congregation near the French, during the French Revolution, 1789 to 1794, just a few years that it's about. So I called Rod and Staff, and they said, yes, they have the book. This was about a week before we were leaving. For $3, we can speed mail it to you. And it came Friday, and we left Monday. So I read it on the plane, and I was really glad I had it. When we visited the Principality of Zalm, the area where this book it describes. And my wife read it on the way home then after. Stephen Mast, who is the editor of the Christian Example. He is he's the editor of this book. He got a Miller girl to write it. Sister Joanna F. Martin from Pennsylvania wrote the book. And she started in 2009. And so you can see it was a good-sized project. And the reason, the way Stephen came upon it was he was talking with Eddie Klein. He was writing editorials in the Christian Example from Songs in the Osbund. And then the third song in the Osbund, do any of you remember what that is? Well, it's a song that talks about this. These people here in the Zalm area. Now, the Principality of Zalm is... although surrounded by France, the Principality of Zalm belonged to the German Zalm family. A prince of this family ruled the principality that was semi-independent of France. That was the setting. And I understand the Anabaptist people from Switzerland, when things got really hot there and they were told to leave, this seemed like a peaceful place to go. It's in the Alsace. And so a lot of the Anabaptists migrated there, and I understand there was, in the height of the Amish community, there was three good-sized Amish districts with a lot of, another thing that interests me is Jacob Kipferschmidt, was the leading bishop there, and Kipfer Schmidt is a variant from Kipfer, so I'm pretty sure he's from our people. So the story, he's one of the main characters in the story. He was a leading bishop. Other names that come into my family tree are Gerber and Nauhauser. And when we were there, that name, we noticed it several places, so there are still some of them there. Anyway, this is, Ali, did you visit there, and did you spend time by the oak tree, the tree of peace? It's an area, because of the altitude, oaks don't grow well, but this tree, there was three men in our group put their arms around it, touching tips of fingers, and they were able, three men were able to reach around it. So a huge oak, but the reason that oak was planted, it's planted as the tree of peace, because these people, in the French Revolution in 1789 to 1794, they were pressured to fight in the army, and they resisted. I mean, they refused to fight, but they petitioned the government. This was the French government now that was trying to get them to draft them, and they wouldn't. Of course, wouldn't kill people and wouldn't go to war. So they petitioned and they went to Paris. Well, backing up a little bit, before that, a government delegation came to visit them and to try to persuade them to have the young men register. And they came to Kipfer Schmidt's house. And others of the people, the church people, were there, and they had he had them sit down and fed them a meal, and after supper he had devotions, and he sang the third song in the Ausbund, and these men listened, and there was a French boy that worked for the Amish people there that did the interpreting, and these officials, as they were singing that song, the third song in the Ausbund, these officials, their eyes became teary. And I don't have the words in front of me right now, the exact words, but they said so much. The leader of that delegation said, you farm and you plant and you do these kind of things and we'll take care of the fighting. Yes, Gary. Okay. Okay, good. Good. Yeah, that's wonderful. So that just gives you a brief insight into that book. Read it. It's available from Rod and Staff. Probably you can get it through Glenn's bulk food store. But there's a lot could be said about it, but I found it real challenging. Yes, Ollie?
Were you in the cemetery?
We were. And we looked at the grave of Jacob Peter or Kipfer Schmidt and some other gravestones. And you don't find old stones like that in Switzerland. And you know the story about that. So it was very interesting. And these people, they didn't have the farming they had in Switzerland, but it was still good. It was a good area. But then I understand that later the French government decided they could no longer be exempt from war, and that's why they're not there anymore. They migrated to the U.S. and Canada. Thank you. Yes.
Well, I'm pretty sure that if I would have known that I would be the only lady and that I have to come up here, that I probably would have hesitated to volunteer. Okay, great. Well, I went home last Wednesday evening just having really enjoyed the topic that Gideon led us in and feeling affirmed that reading is not a selfish thing to do, to take time to do when there's plenty of other things that could be done, but it's an investment, and I really enjoyed that. And then when Marvin said something about talking about a book that's influenced us, I immediately thought of this book, a book by Elizabeth Elliot. The title is Loneliness It can be a wilderness. It can be a pathway to God. It's a book that Mary Jane Knisley, and I'm sorry she's not here tonight, gave to me as a gift about 25 years ago. And I don't know that I've read through it more than two or at the most three times, and I've not read it for years. But as soon as you said that, I remember something that, a way that this book has influenced me tremendously. So I thought maybe I should reread the whole book so I could give a little bit more of an overview, but I didn't do that. I'm just going to talk about that one thing that has really influenced me. It seems to me that we all of us have lots of mentors. Some of our mentors are community, people who are living, and some of our mentors are people who've already died, and that's the way that I'm connecting with this book here. I think, too, that it's true that we cannot grow or mature without someone teaching us or modeling for us what it could look like to live differently. And so when I read in this book about a man named George Matheson, who lived over 100 years ago, he experienced some heart-wrenching pain. He had became engaged and was only engaged for a short time when he went blind. And I don't know how, what happened, but he became blind, and that would be a huge loss. And then soon after that, his fiancée broke their engagement. And I was reading this and feeling the shock and the horror of the loss and the betrayal, and then reading what he did with that. So he sat down, he took his pain to God, and out of that pain he wrote the hymn that we still sing today that says, "O love that will not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be." And it goes on with more verses. But here it says, "His blindness and rejection proved to be for George Matheson the very means of illuminating the love of God." And I was reading that and feeling shocked with... Emotionally, I was involved in the story. And then I come to what she says, Elizabeth Elliot writing, what she says next. She says, "The power of the cross is not exemption from suffering, but the very transformation of that suffering. The way of the cross for George Matheson was heartbreak. God could have spared him of that, but God's love chose instead to give him something far more precious than the happiness he had lost. He gave him the oil of joy." And then went on to say, "If he had not entered that lonely wilderness, George Matheson would not have found his sweet treasure." And now here was the question that just struck my heart when I was reading. Would you say the price of that was too high? And when I read that, my heart said, yes. And the next sentence says, "Your answer depends on where you set your sights, on the short range or the long range." And it takes me back to where I was when I read this. And just somehow, I guess it was a time of the Lord carving out a capacity in my heart to see life through different eyes, that good does come out of bad. Good, bad. The capacity to dare to believe that good could come out of bad. And I pondered that so much and so long that's exactly what I thought of immediately, because I know that many of the things in the last, over my life, many of the times when I have chosen to thank God in the midst of pain or in the midst of darkness has connected with what I learned from George Matheson, who mentored me through this book. And so I'm very grateful for that. I thought it would be kind of neat if we could sing that hymn. It's 514. So if that would work, I'd be glad.
First of all, I want to say I was asked to speak a little more on a book that I talked about a week ago, just so that none of you think I'm anxious for the spotlight. Some of my Amish humility coming in here, I know. But really, I do want you to have the freedom to come up and talk, because I feel like I talked a lot a week ago. Betty, I don't know whether you mentioned this, but Elizabeth Elliot just passed away. Do you know how old she was? And does anyone know? Close to 90, yeah. So just thought that was noteworthy as well. Well, two books I'm going to talk about very briefly. If any of you are wanting to read a biography, I recommend the one on Dietrich Bonhoeffer that came out in the last couple of years by Eric Metaxas. I know that some of the tension that you get into with reading is that some people say, I don't want to read fiction because what do you learn if you read fiction? Well, I personally have something to say about that. I think you learn a lot about human nature and about how life works. But if you would like to read something, if you're adamant about reading history, you could read this book. And it actually, you get two for the price of one, because you get a history, you learn a lot, but it's also very engaging. It's as engaging as fiction. So I highly recommend it. It looks big and intimidating, but once you get started, it's well worth the read. I'm not going to read anything from it. I just want to say that for those, I'm sure 95% of us know this, but Dietrich Bonhoeffer was as Eric Metaxas says, he was a pastor, martyr, prophet, spy. Okay, I ran out of breath. Really, he was, though, and he was all of that, pastor, martyr, prophet, spy, and remarkably in each point. And one of the things that has always stood out to me about him, and ever since I read the book, especially so, was that he read with absolute clarity his times. And, you know, we could argue that we're not living in World War II during the Holocaust, and we don't have anything that big going on around us. Well, maybe, maybe not. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wouldn't have necessarily known that either. But with the spirit and wisdom of God, he was able to discern that. He was an extremely wise man. Although, the one maybe caveat is that he did resort to violence. He would have almost resorted to violence. In some of his writings, it's not quite clear, but it's possible that he was thinking of resorting to violence and taking down Hitler. And in fact, his uncle was the one who came the closest to killing Hitler. And there's some historians think that Bonhoeffer was part of that plot. In any case, the plot failed. So this is an excellent book. You can borrow my copy if you'd like. The other book that I want to talk about for just 1 minute is the book that I was trying to rack my brain. I think the first full-length book that I ever read. Lots of pictures, which delights an 8-year-old, but also can delight a 29-year-old. Still like pictures, but just that it drew me in because of the pictures. So if you're thinking intellectual, you know, heavy, engaging stuff, then it's not the book. But Strawberry Girl by Lois Lenski, excellent, excellent book. I remember that book, and you highbrows are going to sneer at this, but I just remember how it was the book. I'll just give you a brief rundown. I don't have it with me. I wish I would. I might have it available to loan out if you want a copy, if I can find it. But it was a classic Hatfield-McCoy, you know, two neighbor families who couldn't get along. And then in the end, of course, they were able to resolve their conflicts and in a peaceable way. And I just remember that those families, they were named Slater. There was the Slater family and the Boyer family. Those of you who read the book know what I'm talking about. And they were just as real as the Grabers and the Millers and the Yoders living around us. And I just remember that book. And I should have talked about children's literature. I apologize that I didn't. So that was my 1 minute review of children's literature. And I'm sure there are many other great ones out there, if only you would get up and tell us about them. So thank you for your attention.
Well, I'm not in a hurry, but I'll give what I have here. This book, I've had it for some time, and I've been very blessed with the reading. It's Reading from Mennonite Writings by Craig Haas, H-A-A-S. He compiled over 400 articles that Mennonite writers have written. And what really strikes me is that he goes back to the Reformation days and picked out a number up until the present time. And it's the writings that that he gives the perspective of the range of Mennonites and the way they wrote and the way they wrote from the heart what they believed. I'll just give you a quick rundown of just a few of these. One was What Good Can Water Do? By Menno Simons in 1539. Peace Grows Out of Love, Christian Burkholder, from 1792. Then Where to Find Jesus, Jacob Denner, from Germany in 1707. Official Theology, from a man in Colombia, I won't try to pronounce his name, 1989. And then God Help Mother, this is in Family Life, in 1989. Then Saved by Grace, John S. Kaufman, in the 1800s. We Decided to Forgive Them, Simon Schrock, in 1878. You Must Have Seen Glorious, let me try again. You Must Have Seen Glorious Things, from Jan Philips in the Netherlands. And this was in 1635. Then Words Beyond Sound, a fellow from Japan in 1989. And a General Campaign Against Evil, Eber Arnold, in Germany in 1923. Choose a Man of Peace, a man from Zaire, in 1980. And then the last one is If Christ Is to Be Born in Us, Jacob Denner, in Germany in 1707. It is a perspective in a long range of eras, and the different writers. I was just blessed by reading this book.
I brought two books tonight. I had a harder time putting it down to one. One thing that's really been foundational for me is reading biographies of missionaries. And especially to highlight Mountain Rain, the biography of James Fraser. He was a pioneer missionary to the Lisu in China in the early 20th century. And this book really impacted my life. It shows how God revealed himself, really impressed on his heart, gave him a burden for the lost. He was a promising musician, rising star as a scientist in Britain. And he went under China Inland Mission, and God really laid the Lisu on his heart. And even though there were many years of no fruit, it was just on his, God had placed a burden on his heart, and he was able to pray in faith. One thing I really like about it is it's real. Lots of excerpts from his diary about the struggles he went through, but how God met him. And just gives you, you know, very clear little picture of where he was at. Like, here's a little excerpt about where he was living when he talked about his room, this Lisu Hilton Hotel. He thought it was quite adequate, but it's really an outhouse made of bamboos and thatch, all tumbling to pieces. It hasn't come down on top of us yet. It leaked badly, but Old Five, that was his native companion, patched it up by putting plantain leaves over the rotten roofing. The floor was, as usual, plain earth trodden hard, and there were a lot of old bins, baskets, and things all over the ground. But such as it is, I'm very comfortable in it and do not hanker after anything better. He had his Greek Testament and a few other books, a plate, a mug, and some bedding. Rice and vegetables were provided by his host, and his bathroom was a mere 2,000 feet below in the roaring torrent. But then later you start seeing the fruit. You see how God touched people's lives. There was a real harvest, but you also see all the work, hard work that went behind it, the persevering, and God coming down and walking with him. It's been a very challenging book for me that I've read many times. I highly recommend reading some any biographies that fit your style. Nests Above the Abyss by Isabel Coons is a good follow-up to this one, and I would recommend any of her books. If you're up to something a little more challenging, a little deeper, I would recommend A Chance to Die, the biography of Gladys Aylward by Elizabeth Elliot, or Gold Cord, the story of Amy Carmichael. And feel free to ask me for any recommendations if you like. Then I also wanted to just highlight this book a little bit. This is, I guess you would call it historical fiction, where they take lots of real things and make a story in that setting. This title is The Secret Church by Louise A. Vernon, and his setting is Northern Germany, a family that's hearing about the Anabaptists, wondering what's going on, the struggles they go through, and how they actually do find true faith. I have a little inscription here. It was given to me by Mom and Dad at Christmas of 1984 when I was 10 years old. I've read it many times. It's been challenging for me. I think it's very influential in my young years, as well as, and I would recommend her other books. I think she has about four or five of them surrounding Christian figures in history. Thank you.
Well, Johnny reminded me that I forgot announcements. So we're going to have announcements. And while we're doing that, if we can have Linda Rose, Paul Yoder, and Harvey come up. What are your announcements? We have the mic coming.
I'm getting a load of Georgia Freestone peaches in for $14 for a 25-pound box. I think that's a half bushel. And they're probably coming on Friday morning. I do not have a time yet for them, and I will try to let you know as soon as I find out. Please do not call me about it unless you don't know by tomorrow night. Thank you.
Okay. David?
Just to let the young people know that today we received the programs for the youth fellowship meetings that are to be held in Paris, Tennessee, on July 24th to 26th. The theme is Trees of Righteousness, and there are two Kansans who will be having important parts in that in those meetings. One is Brother Dwight here, and the other is Marvin Mast. So we'll have these back here at the back tonight, so help yourselves to them. I'll probably just put them up on the bulletin board where you can take them from there.
We have one in the back. We're also going to take nominations to replace Benji on the midweek planning committee here in just a little bit. Go ahead.
If you want to come to the church in the afternoon, this is just a reminder about the blood drive from 2 to 6. If you know by now when you can make it, you can call me or talk to me after church. If you just see during the day that you can show up, that's great too. Anybody's welcome.
And which day is this?
Did you say Friday, July 3? Yes, that's what I meant.
Okay. This week on Friday. I have a reminder from the renovations committee. Remind the people about the work project at the school. Thursday for the ladies, 9 to noon. Friday for the men, 8 to 4. Lunch will be provided. Could I have a hand count of how many men can help on Friday? Men that can help on Friday. 1? 2? You guys are going to be busy, looks to me like. Okay, if you can help, call Larry. Okay, could we, let's see, Gideon Yutzi is on the committee as well as, Benji is just coming off, and I'm the long-term person at least until September. Do I have nominations for this position? Usually as a young person this time around. That's not to say that Gideon's not pretty young, too. Michael Yutzi. Aaron? Who?
Johnny Yoder.
Johnny Yoder, okay. And I prefer to have two to pick from. Paul, would you help me count? All in favor of Michael Yutzi. Could I have a raise of hands here? Thank you. 17. And Johnny Yoder. What'd you have here?
16.
Okay, it looks like Johnny wins it by a landslide. So. Thank you. Any other announcements? Johnny will be our new midweek planning committee person. I wanted to read the story in the Bible where the guy read to fall asleep. But I decided not to. But you can find that in Esther, where he said, "Bring me the book so I can fall asleep." Let's see here. Who is next now? Linda.
I bought this book in 2010, Foreign to Familiar. It wasn't a totally new concept to me, but it did open my eyes to how important it is to try to understand the perspective of the people that I work with, communicate with, and so forth. Foreign to Familiar by Sarah Lanier. A few quotes from the book are, and this talks about the different kinds of people that tend to be in different kinds of climates. She says, "Cultural differences among us provide both the richest color to our lives and the harshest wounding. Good intentions can be read wrongly, damaging relationships with colleagues without knowing it." And she emphasizes that the things she says are generalizations. There are exceptions and probably quite a few of them. But generally speaking, people who live in hot climates tend to relate to each other with relationships as a priority. People in cold climates tend to relate to their work as that is the important thing, the task and efficiency oriented. And in more detail, those in the hot climate people, and that often includes people from the cold climate, people who are rural or agricultural, tribal, they begin even business conversations with pleasantries first, rather than just starting in with business. This was especially helpful for President Jimmy Carter. He's from the Deep South in the U.S., and he knew how important this aspect was when he was trying to negotiate with world leaders from the warm climate countries. And it was particularly frustrating one time when he was meeting with leaders from Israel and Egypt. They spent hours talking about important subjects like their grandchildren and that kind of thing before they really got to business. But it was very helpful in building their trust. People from hot climate people areas generally consider it very important to avoid offending or embarrassing somebody else. And sometimes if they ask, someone asks them a question, they don't know the answer, they think it's way too rude to say they don't know, and so they will say something just to maintain that friendly atmosphere, even if it's the wrong thing. Also, people from hot climate communities generally feel part of a group. They have a real group concept. They're part of the family and the church. They hold their possessions loosely. Their possessions are available for others in the group. And then, more specifically on the cold climate, those people tend to be more individualistic. And they feel like you should say what you think rather than being so concerned about how others feel about it. And also very task and efficiency oriented. The author writes that people from cold climate cultures seem to think those from the hot climate cultures, when they're thinking about time, they're always late. And the hot climate people, when they're thinking about what the cold climate people think about time, they feel like they're neurotically time-oriented. I have a number of Amish relatives in Kelowna, Iowa, including this Roy Beachy that we prayed for tonight. In 08, Dorcas Smucker from Oregon and some of her relatives visited some Amish people from Kelowna, including my Uncle Glenn and Aunt Susan Beachy's family. She writes, work about these Amish. Work, one gathers, is top priority. Well, no, not top priority. That's reserved for guests. Since everywhere we went, they dropped everything they were doing to visit with us. The barefooted woman with 12 children who was canning meat for a wedding in 2 weeks. The large clan at Glenn and Susan Beachy's who were having a work day for their parents, grandparents, and who came out of the woodwork in droves when we arrived. Men, women, teenagers, maiden aunts, and lots of children. They all left everything to talk to us. We felt like royalty. And then in conclusion, something that Thomas Jefferson wrote about our country almost 230 years ago. This was in a personal letter. With respect to my countrymen, I have studied their character with attention. I had even ascribed this to its cause, to that warmth of their climate which unnerves and unmans both body and mind. While on this subject, I will give you my idea of the characters of the several states. In the North, they are cool, sober, laborious, persevering, independent, jealous of their own liberties and just to those of others, interested, superstitious and hypocritical in their religion. In the South, they are fiery, indolent, unsteady, independent, zealous for their own liberties, but trampling on those of others, generous, candid, without attachment or pretensions to any religion but that of the heart. These characteristics grow weaker and weaker by gradation from north to south and south to north, insomuch that an observing traveler, without the aid of the quadrant, may always know his latitude by the character of the people among whom he finds himself.
When I heard the invitation this evening, my mind immediately went to a little booklet called The Calvary Road that dates me. I think the people my age remember that. It was published the first time in 1950. And as a young boy who was very immature, but deep in my heart, somehow there was a longing to see reality, the reality of God in my life. And of course, in one little booklet, you don't find it all written. But it awakened something that I never got away from. And every time I open it, it speaks to my heart. And it simply has to do about brokenness. And it's written by a British evangelist who was finding his campaigns becoming dry. And he encountered a few brothers from Africa. And there was a continuous revival going on there. And it was not the type of revival that, you know, with big crowds and that type of thing, but it was on a personal basis of people simply opening their hearts to the Lord, becoming transparent before Him, and being willing to break their hard wills. That's the emphasis. And to see that God, we know revival is simply going from down here to being built up to where God wants us to be, to doing a work in us. And he can only do that in humble, clean vessels. And this is his emphasis. If we want God to do his work, it is only God who can do the work, but our part is to be transparent. Just a few things. The self-life. It is self who is often doing Christian work. It is always self who gets irritable and envious and resentful and critical and worried. It is self who is hard and unyielding in its attitude to others. It is self who is shy and self-conscious and reserved. No wonder we need breaking. As long as self is in control, God can do little with us, for the fruit of the Spirit with which God longs to fill us is the complete antithesis of the dark, unbroken spirit within us. Being broken is both God's work and ours. If we are really open to conviction as we seek fellowship with God, God will show us the expression of this proud heart self that causes him pain. Brokenness in daily experience is simply the response of humility to the conviction of God. And then the companion, he wrote this afterwards, and he said, hey, we would see Jesus is not after this, but he felt this was incomplete. As Jesus is the answer to that need, he is the one who wants to break us and fill us. And these two books have just, you know, not in perfection, but have drawn me back again and again. And especially when we were in Belgium and we were facing personal struggles and relational struggles. And then I read this. Service seems so unselfish. And whereas concentrating on a walk with God seems selfish and self-centered, but it is the very reverse. The things that God is most concerned about are our coldness of heart towards himself and our proud, unbroken natures. Christian service of itself can, and so often does, leave our self-centered nature untouched. That is why there is scarcely a church, a mission station, or a committee undertaking a special piece of service that is without an unresolved problem of personal relationships eating out its heart and thwarting its progress. This is because Christian service often gives us opportunities of leadership and position that we could not attain in the secular world, and we quickly fall into pride, self-seeking, and ambition. With those things hidden in our hearts, we have only to work alongside others, and we find resentment, hardness, criticism, jealousy, and frustration issuing from our hearts. We think we are working for God, but the test of how little of our service is for him is revealed by our resentment or self-pity when that is taken away from us. In this condition, we are trying to give to others an answer which we have not truly and deeply found for ourselves. And that has just blessed me, and I veered from that, but it's just been kind of a guiding post, a quest for my personal life. Oh, I'm sorry, Roy Hessen. We would see Jesus, and I don't think this isn't in print anymore. I think you have to find it on used books, but I think this is still in print, the Calvary Road.
David Ells had something here a while back. He brought the FCM paper along and was advocating that people would read this.
You know, that's one of the things that I do. Periodicals or the papers that come in our mailboxes, I read those, and I read the Calvary Messenger. Calvary Messenger came day before yesterday, and I have read it from cover to cover. And there was something in there did you know that we've got a new editor for the youth section, which is our beloved Gideon Yutzi, and he had something in there in his response that hurt me. He said they asked the young people how many of them are reading the Calvary Messenger. I guess that was at a youth fellowship meetings. A few hands went up, and then when they saw no more hands are coming, they quit putting theirs down. And I think that's a shame. I think we've got a paper that is worthy, and I think it's worthy of paying attention. I think we should give Gideon our support in this. And I'd read newsletters from Christian Aid Ministries, from CAM, and Christian Aid from CAM, and from the MZL and NYP, and a whole lot more. I read. Besides the Stillwaters, I read the Pathway papers. You know, we may not always agree with those, but I venture to say that we can learn something from the Pathway publications. I enjoy them and I read them. I also read quite a few books. I go to the library down here and try to find books that would interest me. Some of my favorite authors are Harvey Yoder, Pablo Yoder, Christmas Carol Kaufman. You know, it's interesting how I can read a book 5, 6, 10 years ago, and I pick it up again, and I read it, and it's probably just as interesting, and I get as emotionally involved in those books as I do, and things that are more recent. So I picked up a book, and I'm embarrassed that I didn't write the name of the author down, but the name of the book down, but the author is Bernard Palmer. It was written by Moody Press, and the book is a novel of an Indian boy that became an orphan when he was an infant, and he grew up to be he was kicked around. He grew up to be a very bitter man, and drinking and all the rest. But when he came to the Lord worked in his heart, and he gave his heart to the Lord and went into full-time Christian service. And those are the kind of books that I enjoy picking up and reading. And so that's what I've got to.
Well, our time is up, but we still have a few people that want to say something. I'm not sure. Can we condense just a little bit? Those of you, I have John and Laverne. How about you, David? Do you want to say something too?
I just wanted to say that those who have to leave.
Well, my dad used to say if we can finish up in 10 minutes, let's go ahead and do it. And if not, we should shut down. So let's try to finish in another few minutes. So John and Laverne, would you come up?
The Call by Oz Guinness was a pivotal book for me in my teens. He discusses finding and fulfilling the central purpose of your life. He says essentially that following Jesus is the purpose of your life. That is the central purpose. And then there's a secondary purpose, which is which comes out of who you are. The specifics come from who God made you to be. For brevity's sake, he ends each chapter with a paragraph of questions to help you reflect on what he just wrote. And I'll read that, and then I'll be done. Do you want the best and most wonderful gifts God has given you to decay, spent on your own self? Or do you want them to be set free to come into their own as you link your profoundest abilities with your neighbor's need and the glory of God? Listen to Jesus of Nazareth. Answer his call. Thank you.
Well, I hadn't volunteered earlier, Marvin, because the book that I'm going to talk about, I haven't finished reading. I thought I shouldn't give a report on a book I haven't finished reading. But reference was made to this in the minutes of the feasibility committee meeting just recently, Going Till You're Gone. And it's written by Gary Miller, from, is it Utah or Idaho, from the northwest somewhere. And where is it, Gary? From Idaho, okay. I was in one of his workshops at Faith Builders Reach 2015 conference, and Gary has some exceptional gifts. And this book addresses how middle-aged and older look at issues of retirement. And he has the ability to use captivating illustrations, and he asked the question, is comfortable retirement really the goal for followers of Jesus? And is leisure and just taking life easy and enjoying pleasure really what retirement should be about? It's a very arresting book, and I think you will find this good reading. I will just also say that one of the books that influenced me as a young person was the Triumph of John and Betty Stamm, and the story of their martyrdom. And permit me just a little bit of history. At the time that I checked that book out of the church library was right behind this door in one or two shelves here. So the library has grown, and I hope it will continue to grow. Blessings.
Well, talking about continuing to grow, I noticed tonight that there was a substantial selection of children's books in the back, one of which is an old favorite of mine, Bedtime for Francis. So those of you who like to read those will want to check those out for your children or grandchildren. I also want to tell you about Hinds Feet in High Places. My daughter Emily said, that's a book that she didn't want me to say that. But she said, this is a book that impacted her. So it is an allegory of Christian life. And I'm really sorry I can't read a story from James Herriot, Every Living Thing. So, let's all stand and we'll sing the doxology.